Will the members please indicate their presence by voting? Has any member failed to indicate their presence by voting? Will the clerk please take the roll?
27 members present.
Representative Grusendorf?
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I pressed my button, but it didn't show, and I wish the clerk would indicate that I am present.
Thank you, Representative Grusendorf. The clerk will indicate your presence. Representative Liska?
Well, Speaker, mine apparently not working either.
Will the clerk please indicate Representative Liska's presence? Representative Abood.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Excuse from the call today are Representative Ewling and Fritz, and I note the presence of both of them on the floor. Representative Hayes, Representative Cowdery, and Representative McBride are excused from the call today.
For the members that just came in, would you please indicate your presence by voting? Will the members please rise for the invocation by Reverend Dwayne Minkler of the First Church of God?
Precious Heavenly Father, as we begin this new week, help us to reach out to new possibilities. Father, it's so easy to spend time. I would pray that today you would help us to invest our time. I pray for each of our representatives and the decisions before them this week, that, Father, you would give them wisdom and courage and strength to move our state forward. Father, we commit ourselves first, our families, our community, our state, and our nation to you now, asking that you will lead us on. Thank you, Father, for the blessings you've given. We praise you and thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I move and ask unanimous consent that the prayer be spread on the journal.
Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Madam Speaker.
Will the clerk please certify the journal for the 82nd, 83rd, and 84th legislative days and journal supplement number 119?
As Chief Clerk, I certify as to the correctness of the journal for the 82nd, 83rd, and 84th days and House supplement number 119.
Madam Speaker, I move and ask unanimous consent that the journal for the 82nd, 83rd, and 84th legislative days and the journal supplement number 119 be approved as certified by the Chief Clerk.
Hearing none, so ordered. Are there guests for introduction? Representative Bussell.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. With us today in Gallery A is a constituent of both Representative Lindauer's and mine, a person known to a number of the people here. I'd like the body to help me welcome Oscar Gadez.
Message from the governor.
I have a message from the governor on Senate Committee Substitute for Committee Substitute for House Bill 635 Finance, making special appropriations to state agencies for development projects and for payment as grants to municipalities and unincorporated communities for development grants, Chapter 21, SLA 1984. There are line item vetoes in this, and it has been duplicated and placed on each member's desk. I have another letter, Senate Committee Substitute for Committee Substitute for House Bill 636, Finance, making appropriations for transportation-related capital projects, Chapter 22, SLA 1984. It also has been duplicated and placed on each member's desk. And I have another letter for Senate Committee Substitute for Committee Substitute for House Bill 637, Finance, making special appropriations to the University of Alaska for capital projects and for payment as grants to municipalities and unincorporated communities for post-secondary facilities, Chapter 23, SLA 1984. This one also has been duplicated and placed on each member's desk. I have no further messages from the governor, Madam Speaker.
Messages from the Senate.
The Senate adopted the third Conference Committee report on Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 257, Judiciary, and House Committee Substitute for Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 257, Judiciary Amended House Legislative Ethics Effective Date, thus adopting Second Conference Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 257, an act relating to standards of conduct of legislators and legislative employees, and establishing a select committee on legislative ethics and providing for an effective date. The Senate passed House Bill 291, Tuberculosis Examinations and Quarantines, March 29, and it is returned. This bill has been sent to enrolling. The Senate approved the following citations, and they are transmitted for consideration. Honoring Nancy Lord, honoring Michael Clearly, and in memoriam, John Edelook. The Senate has passed the following, and they are transmitted for consideration. Senate Bill 387 by the Rules Committee by request of the Governor, an act relating to state employment.
That will be referred to the State Affairs and Finance Committees.
Committee Substitute for Senate Concurrent Resolution Number 38, Judiciary by the Judiciary Committee, relating to out-of-court settlements by the state.
Will be referred to the Judiciary Committee.
I have no further messages from the Senate, Madam Speaker.
Other communications.
We are in receipt of the Alaska Land Use Council in a spirit of cooperation. This report will be on file in the clerk's office. I have no further communications, Madam Speaker.
Reports of standing committees.
No, I have none.
Reports of special committees.
The Conference Committee on House Bill 258, Special Tax Credit, requests powers of limited free conference to address the following, and there are six items. They will be duplicated and placed on each member's desk. And it was signed by Representative Cowdery as chairman, Representative Furness, and Representative Kopanen. I have no further special committee reports.
Introduction of citations and resolutions.
Citation honoring Diana Murphy by Representative M.M. Miller. I have no resolutions for introduction, Madam Speaker.
Introduction, first reading, and reference of bills.
House Bill 712 by the Labor and Commerce Committee, an act relating to provision of services under the Medical Assistance Program.
That will be referred to the Health, Education, Social Services Committee and the Finance Committee.
House Bill 713 by the Labor and Commerce Committee, an act relating to the practice of physical therapy.
Will be referred to the Health, Education, and Social Service Committee.
I have no further bills for introduction, Madam Speaker.
This brings us to the consideration of the daily calendar. Will the clerk please read the first item on today's calendar?
House Joint Resolution Number 53 by Martin, relating to the reapportionment of the legislature. The Committee on State Affairs is at House Joint Resolution 53 under consideration. Recommends it be replaced with Committee Substitute for House Joint Resolution 53, State Affairs, with the same title, and reports it back with, as follows, and attaches a physical note. The report was signed by Mr. Abood, Chairman, signing Dupass, Abood, Cowdery, and Ward. Having no recommendation, Larson, Schultz, Locker, and M.M. Miller signed do not pass unless amended. The Committee on Judiciary has had House Joint Resolution 53, under consideration and recommends it be replaced with Committee Substitute for House Joint Resolution 53, State Affairs, with the same title, and recommends it do pass. Report was signed by Mr. Bussell, Chairman, signing do pass, Liska, Hayes, Barnes, and Bussell. Signing do not pass, inadequate consideration, Clarkson. Having no recommendation, Wente. The Committee on Finance has had the resolution under consideration and recommends it be replaced with Committee Substitute for House Joint Resolution 53, Finance, with the same title. I've already had them in. And reports back as follows and attaches a new fiscal note. The report was signed by Mr. Adams, Chairman, signing Dupass, Martin, Furness, Lindauer, and Ward. Having no recommendation, Adams, Bettesworth, Grusendorf, and Hurlbert, and Fritz. Signing do not pass, Jara.
Will the House please stand at ease? That I wish to make them. When you have amendments from now on that needs to be duplicated and placed on people's desks, the Chief Clerk will have them duplicated and returned to the sponsor to give to the pages to pass out. Representative Locker.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. May we revert to introduction of guests?
Without objections, we're under introduction of guests.
Okay, Madam Speaker, we have today a young lady from the Mat-Su Borough who is working as a volunteer page. We're very proud of Holly Sheldon. She is from Talkeetna and attends Sioux Valley High. She is here because Mat-Su Borough businessmen are working with my office and sponsoring these students in order to allow state government to get closer to our Mat-Su students. Holly Sheldon.
Before the at ease, we were to the daily calendar, Irene.
Yes, I have two committee substitutes for House Joint Resolution 53 on my desk, Madam Speaker.
Representative Abood.
Madam Speaker, I move and ask unanimous consent that the Finance Committee substitute for House Joint Resolution 53 be adopted in lieu of the original resolution.
Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
I have no amendments on my desk, Madam Speaker.
Representative Abood.
Madam Speaker, I move and ask unanimous consent the committee substitute for House Joint Resolution 53 Finance be considered engrossed, advanced to third reading, and placed on final passage.
Objection? Hearing none, the Finance Committee substitute for House Joint Resolution 53 is adopted in lieu of the original bill. Is there debate?
Question.
Representative Martin.
Yes, thank you, Madam Speaker. I think that this resolution is a bill that whose time has come in the sense that we are answering the major question that the Supreme Court has suggested over the past 25 years that the legislators address. Probably the most important question in the past few years in a couple cases, Egan versus Gore and so on, had to do with the counting of civilians only in Alaska. And I think that over the years, the courts, at least in two state cases, have expressed themselves very clearly that we cannot deprive people from being counted as residents merely by their occupation, and especially our military people, who by constitution were not allowed to be counted. This resolution corrects that problem. The resolution also corrects the problem in the old language that was used pertaining to a quotient divided by 40, and with the suggestion of the state Supreme Court that we use the language that complies with the federal court decision of 1965, the purity of one person, one vote is equality. We do answer the question that was brought before the courts in the past. Does the governor have the right to reapportion the Senate districts? And the Supreme Court says, yes, they do. They have to do that. The Senate must be apportioned by population, not geography. So by this change, we comply with the wishes of the state Supreme Court in changing that also. The other major question that is answered here is in page 2, line 13 and 14, where we delete the old language pertaining to population, and according to the U.S. Supreme Court, Barker versus Carr, allow one person, one vote to be the supreme rights of the people for equality. Two other issues that were addressed but not necessarily asked by the Supreme Court of the state of Alaska. One has to do is a percentage. What is the fair percentage of disparity throughout the state or district? Should it be 10%? Should it be 15%? Should it be no limits on it whatsoever? And as our Constitution now, one judge told me that you could have as high as 40%, 45% disparity, and yet it is not against our Constitution. But in the southern 48, the states have made it very clear, U.S. District Court, with the backup I sent to all members, saying that the most that will be acceptable is probably a 10% disparity between one district and another. That means 5 above or 5% below the equality number. Then also we have the 1% statewide disparity that was corrected in the finance version, which probably tightens up a little more the potentials of what some people call gerrymandering, but this would emphasize the purity of the one person, one vote.
Before we have further debate, I got a little ahead of myself. Would the clerk please read the bill for the third and final time?
Committee Substitute for House Joint Resolution 53, financed by the Finance Committee, relating to the reapportionment of the legislature.
Further debate, Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I rise in opposition to the resolution before us because I think it's totally inadequate with regard to addressing the real concerns that many people have expressed in the current reapportionment that is being advanced now to the courts. Let me see if I can bring it to your attention, and specifically the inadequacy that I believe exists in this bill is the fact that the socioeconomic consideration and that disparity that exists, particularly in South Anchorage, in the North Keene or in the Kiske area, and what I understand to be the condition that may exist in the Metlakatla area, is specifically not addressed. And to me, that's a shortcoming that should be addressed because we're not like the lower 48. We're not like the people in the lower 48 where you have a compactness that exists that allows you to get to strict percentages of distribution. Madam Speaker, I think it's important to note that if this was on the books today and the courts were having to rule on it, that you'd find that the current reapportionment plan would probably stand because of the conditions by which they went to strict percentages. Madam Speaker, I think that we have to look hard at this proposal that's before us because I think that the people of Nikiski should not be disenfranchised, that they should not be isolated from the rest of the people in Kenai. I think the people of South Anchorage deserve compact representation. I think across the state of Alaska, we need to come together and look at true representation. And as the sponsor indicated, this more is put together based on population statistical analyses that bring us down to strict percentages and not really considering that we do have a vast state. We have a geography that spans basically the east coast to west coast of the United States. And I think that we have to have the flexibility in any type of reapportionment or apportionment that allows us to have common grounds, the basic socio and economic conditions to be accounted for. Madam Speaker, I have a lot of problems with this legislation. I think it's poorly drafted from that perspective, and it would not even, from my perspective, be warranted being on this floor at this time. It's totally negligent in considering all the myriad of problems that we've had advanced to us through the courts. And Madam Speaker, I would just hope that each and every one of us looks very carefully at this legislation before it's allowed to advance. Because one way or the other, the people of Alaska deserve fair and equitable representation, and they won't get it with this particular legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Just a question to the sponsor here on line 12 on the first page. They talk about single-member districts. I assume then that people who would be running for the House of Representatives then would just represent about half the area that they represent now. Is that correct? And what would be the exact statistical breakdown on the number of voters per each House seat?
Representative Martin.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. If I may answer that question. If you take the 1980 statistics, it should be 9,200 persons per single House district. And the disparities that are current, and this is what I hope that members don't look at, but they're going to use it as examples, so such is life. We should look at the future, 1990, when this kicks in. But you can use today's proposed reapportionment as example of disparity. In Southeast Alaska, for instance, of the six House seats that are available, two House members have 8,300 people to serve. On the other end, two House members have 9,800 people to serve. So you see a disparity of almost 1,600 people between those members. Now, maybe they don't mind, but at the same time, you do have disparity. And at the same time, it may be very costly for a candidate who is in a double House seat compared to a candidate who is in a single House seat, whether it be for the Senate or for the House of Representatives. The U.S. Supreme Court and U.S. District Court has ruled, regardless of what the fellow from South Anchorage said, I really don't think he read the packet, but he would realize the value of protecting the purity of our Constitution, which was meant one person, one vote. In a case by Judge Bright, 1974, Chapman versus Meyer, a U.S. constitutional question, it gives 10, and I won't read them, 10 major reasons for the purity of democracy in single-member districts, that it can be manipulated, that ethnic groups have been disenfranchised from proper representation, that small neighborhoods have been disenfranchised because of devil district. The gentleman brought up the people of Nikiski, and that's a very good example why you should vote for this particular bill. Because if you had single-member district, Nikiski would not be gerrymandered out to be in Palmer. The perfect example, and I'm glad you brought it out. If you had single-member district, the senators from Kenai would not necessarily have to be running in South Anchorage. The gentleman from South Anchorage would not have to go down to Nikiski to run for his single-member seat. He has enough population right there. So the beauty, the value, as the courts have said about single-member district, both for Senate and House, it greatly decreases gerrymandering, and it also protects the individual voters because they get spread out much less. It helps the average citizen to run for public office because you have a less geographical area to work in. The other point that the, well, I won't cast in the guy from South Anchorage because I really don't believe he read the bill.
Further debate? Representative Clarkson.
Madam Speaker, I'd like to take a minute to describe my perceptions of this legislation and indicate some problems I have with it. First of all, I think you need to understand that the proposed constitutional amendment has basically two parts. There are those parts of it that are not policy questions. They are simply bringing our Constitution up to reflect what the existing constitutional mandates are. Those provisions are not very controversial, and in fact, if they were not incorporated in our Constitution, we'd still have to abide by them because they're rules of the United States Supreme Court, for example, the one man, one vote, one person, one vote principle. So there are portions of this legislation that are really not very controversial and we don't even need, but it's nice to clean up the Constitution. The second are our policy questions, Mr. Speaker. I've gone through and identified the policy questions in this legislation in the finance version, and if you want to follow along, you can at least identify which ones that there's some sort of issue about. The first is on page 1, line 14, the question of single-member districts. The second, Madam Speaker, is on page 1, line 23, with regard to each Senate district being composed of two House districts. It's a policy question. There's no real mandate from the U.S. Supreme Court on that question. The third, on page 2, line 5, eliminates the requirement that we use census data in evaluating what the number of residents are in the state. And I'm going to have a question in a minute about why that is deemed desirable. That's a policy question, Madam Speaker. On page 2, lines 24 and 26 are policy questions with regard to the percentage deviation that you can have between and among districts. It's 1% and 3%. Those are the primary policy questions that we have before us. Mr. Speaker, with regard to those, on the single-member districts, I read the material that was provided to us, although I did not have the opportunity to do so before consideration by the Judiciary Committee. I have had since then. And there are a number of Supreme Court cases there that argue very compellingly that we should not allow a long list of people to run at large and then simply take the top 14, like I think it was a few years ago in Anchorage. I think the worst we got in Anchorage was everybody runs at large and you take the top 14. That was perceived to be, in these court decisions, a very bad precedent, a very bad way to handle reapportionment, to allow that, and I agree with that. And, of course, so do the reapportionment boards for the last couple of times around, because they have eliminated that system. So, Mr. Speaker, the arguments in favor, as I can glean them from the material, for single-member districts in the Constitution are, first of all, that the alternative is large at-large election, and that's not a good idea. The answer to that is that we don't have that now. The second argument is that you ought to provide a simple, clear choice to the voter between two people, but that's really better than having them pick from a slate of 20 or 30. Have them choose between two. Well, Mr. Speaker, we have that, Madam Speaker. We have that right now with the designated seats. So the argument is not as compelling with regard to single-member districts. The other argument for single-member districts is that it permits direct communication with the legislator, and I suspect that there's not much we can do in the Constitution to improve on the existing system. That is, that I've got a pretty good-sized district. I keep pretty good contact with it, and I think the rest of us do, so I'm not sure that there's a grievance there. Then there's the argument that it's harder to hide from the voters, and it's harder if you're in a single-member district to hide behind coalition politics or hide behind binding caucus votes or any of that, and of course we don't do that here, so I'm not sure that that's much of an argument. And there is some argument about reducing campaign cost. I'm not quite sure whether we would reduce it by reducing each of our districts in half. Maybe there would be a slight savings there. My point here with regard to single-member districts is we've done just about everything that this constitutional amendment would require already by having designated seats for the two-member districts. I don't run against the other member who's in this body from my district. There is no at-large election in Anchorage. And, of course, for those single-member districts in the rural areas, they wouldn't be affected by this at all. So I'm not sure that that's a compelling reason to adopt this legislation, Mr. Speaker. The other argument that's worth looking at is the question of the 2% or the 1% and 3%. In an earlier version, it was 2% and 4%. Mr. Speaker, it's my judgment that simply unduly restricts the flexibility of the reapportionment board. In a state with the unique geography of Alaska, you cannot eliminate the disparities to the degree you can in urbanized states. You have many districts in Alaska that are largely urban and partially rural. So you have drastic variations. From one block away, you can have a dense area with a lot of residents and a lot of voters, and then a block away in the same district, you can have very, very few residents, very low density. So it's very hard to draw those lines carefully so as to essentially eliminate the disparity, and that's what 1% and 3% would do. Mr. Speaker, it's just simply not feasible to reduce the flexibility of the reapportionment board in light of the urban-rural differences and the geographic dynamics of Alaska. So I think that's unduly restrictive. Mr. Speaker, in the material presented by the sponsor of this legislation, there was some material from the, I think it was Common Cause, and there's been a reference this is a tracks the Common Cause proposal, and I think if you compare this with a Common Cause proposal, you really identify the defects in this proposed amendment. The Common Cause proposal suggests three elements, all of which are crucial to any real reform of the reapportionment process. Those elements are, first, to restrict and eliminate discretion so as to avoid gerrymandering. The second is to reorganize a reapportionment system and the board to eliminate the partisan aspects of a reapportionment board And the third is to provide clear and prompt judicial review with clear standards of review. Now, Mr. Speaker, the effort here before us only attempts to accomplish that first goal, to reduce gerrymandering. And as I've indicated, I'm not sure that it reflects the unique characteristics of Alaska with regard to its solution, but does absolutely nothing about what are really the two key defects in our system. One is a partisan, although it's certainly not characterized that way in the statute, but definitely a partisan reapportionment board. Now, if you trace the last two reapportionments, no one can seriously doubt that it does have some partisan characteristics. Now, obviously, those people try to do what they can and produce an objective judgment, but it's impossible with a board the way it's made up. We thought it was terrible 10 years ago, and some other people now think it's terrible this year. The way to do that is some legitimate reform of the reapportionment board process. There's none of that in this legislation, Madam Speaker. And so it seems to me that we aren't addressing the real problem. The second problem that the Common Cause model proposes is prompt judicial review. We've done absolutely nothing with regard to that. For those of you that have been paying attention to the reapportionment issue this year, you'll realize how important that is. Nobody really knows now what's going to happen with any judicial review of this reapportionment. We don't know how long it's going to take. We didn't know whether a trial court judge had the power to alter the reapportionment plan or whether it's up to the Supreme Court. There's no guidelines whatsoever, and so we're left in a very confusing situation. So for that reason, Madam Speaker, it seems to me that two of the three goals of real reform in the area of reapportionment have not been met by this legislation. The third goal, that of eliminating gerrymandering, is not solved because it doesn't take into account the geographical uniqueness of Alaska.
Further debate? Representative Ward.
Thank you very much, Madam Speaker. I have a question to the sponsor. If this piece of legislation was enacted into law now, would the representative from South Anchorage, says voters, be in the donut district with the president of the other body?
Representative Martin.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. There's no guarantee, but they have enough bodies within that area to be a single district without being gerrymandered to anything. It's a matter of who's on the reapportionment board and where they decide to draw the lines. The facts are very clear through Common Cause more than anything else. And I hate to admit that, but I had to confess it. This is an ultra-liberal group, and I just happened to find that I agree with them for once. And they've been doing a fantastic job in the Southern 48 in solving the problems of reapportionment in those states that have discriminated because of gerrymandering, that have discriminated because of very loose constitutions, as we have in Alaska. And Common Cause did verify the latest reapportionment amendment that we have here. So it's not that we just read the report and forgot about it. There's been regular communications. Madam Chairman, or Madam Speaker, if I may, I'd like to elaborate a little more on what the gentleman from downtown Anchorage brought up, because they're very important points. And I'm glad to see that he had a chance to read this. As he knows, I've been bugging him for, about 2 weeks. And I think he told me Friday he had a chance to glance at it. Hopefully over the weekend he read a little more. He must have, because he read some of the concerns that Common Cause brings up, and they're very true. How are we going to change the reapportionment board to make it non-biased? I think that our Constitution right now is pretty good in the sense that you have five members from different geographical areas of the state. That's real good. And it says no political biases. That's good. I don't know what else you can say beyond that, specifically in the Constitution. We did look under different plans that are being explored in the Southern 48. California has a very good one where the governor himself established a new reapportionment board, but it will be made in geographical areas of retired appellate court justices. Well, they have enough retired justices to do that. and certainly they have a long geographical state, and they can do that. But in our case, it's not the wording in the Constitution. It's how it's implemented and the person that is selected. And this is not saying anything about the current governor or the past governors or what. The weakness is not within the Constitution pertaining to that particular statement, and that had been verified by Common Cause that they thought the wording was okay. The other section that, where are we going to draw lines? I do admit that the people who have worked on this reapportionment plan and on the past reapportionment plan have had difficulty with the federal census people. And now the federal census people, ironically, will reapportion states after this year. And I hope to go to a meeting, and I hope that a couple of the members that were on this reapportionment board will get with the federal people established in September for helping states establish new statistical guidelines that will match. Ours hasn't been done for almost 30 years, and the state has grown tremendously since that time. And even in an area like Fairbanks, the statistical blocks do not match in any way, shape, or form the growth of the city up there. So now they're willing to, all the states that currently have reapportionment plans or constitutional amendments, to work with them and reestablish new federal census tracts. I think that'd be a big step for us. The gentleman mentioned about the legality of some that was put in here. Well, perhaps he's right, but I thought that Harvard Law School, and I don't know if you attend that school or not, gentleman from downtown, but they're supposed to be some of the best in the nation on democracy and on the freedom of the individuals and protecting the rights of the one person, one vote. And some of this suggestion did come from the Harvard Law School in protection of the individual, and also keeping in consideration no matter how big and or small a state is. You see, you can take a state like New Jersey that probably has the highest density population. It's 18,000 persons per mile, per square mile. And they have their problems there too on a percentage basis on what neighborhood gets cut out, what apartment building gets cut out. But from their experience, 1% and 3% worked very well in keeping balance between districts. We can take New Jersey, and the Supreme Court ruled last August, the people, the ethnic group, that definitely were cut out from a district that they had been associated with for years. But for some reason or other, someone decided to cut them out. And it was less than 1% disparity between the districts. Jersey Supreme Court says that this is adequate. They upheld the redistricting. The people were upset. They took it to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court said that less than 1%, when you know the difference, and when the purpose is discrimination, is not adequate. And that neighborhood was allowed back in that particular district. So you see, we can argue about numbers, but I think if you ask the Supreme Court judges of this state and one Superior Court justice that I talked to, I had no idea when we began working on this last year putting in a percentage, but it was recommended in Judge Moore's testimony in voting on the Carpenter case, Carpenter versus Hammond case. The legislature should, it would help in protecting the one person, one vote criteria if we put in a percentage, and that's why we began looking at history. Judge Moore said that 11.5 disparity between District 24 and District 25 will not be upheld by the courts. So we looked into those two districts. What was the difference here? The difference was is how military people were counted. And there's the important clause. Mr. Clausen said there's nothing controversial going on right now. Oh, yes, there is. In every case since 1960, since our statehood, the courts have ruled you must change this way of counting military people. In 1965, under the Juneau chairman, they decided not to count any military whatsoever. And the courts ruled that this disenfranchises people from being counted as citizens purely because of their occupation. But they let it go because no one challenged it. In 1980, the military people were counted in different ways. In the Southeast, they were counted 100% of residents. In the Aleutian chain, they counted almost 100% military as residents. In Anchorage area, Fairbanks area, Kodiak, they were counted the true percentage, the true numbers of military, because the federal people went out to every military establishment and did a head count, person by person, the true number of military and residents of the state who were military. There should have been no guessing game. There should have been no disparity whatsoever on how military were counted. And certainly Judge Moore ruled that you cannot discriminate against them and count them differently in different sections of the state. Yes, to the gentleman from downtown Anchorage, it is a very controversial issue. And it makes a tremendous difference on who has a representative or who does not have a representative. In correcting the Judge Moore problem between 24, District 24 and 25, the reapportionment board merely subtracted 890 people from the military base of ADAC who were overcounted in the first place. There was no change in people whatsoever. It just mattered that, well, we decreased the number of people we counted in ADAC as residents, and now we're balanced. They had that one district change, so yes, they are under the 10% disparity. But with the new plan, you have 28 seats that are more than 10% disparity. So they said in their own scenario here, we corrected the one problem, but they don't allow the courts to know we created 28 new problems. The gentleman said that if the courts would review, and it is very clear that the Common Call said judicial review immediately instead of procrastinating will help many problems. And I agree with that. But who's at fault? Who has control of the courts in this state? I understand that the judges are having a heck of a problem because no one wants to answer what they truly see as a truly unconstitutional plan this year. Yes, they are procrastinating. They got orders from the governor and attorney general that says implement it right away, and that is completely wrong, Madam Chairman. They know they are disobeying the federal rule on the Voters' Rights Act of 1965 that said very clearly you cannot implement any new constitutional plan until it had been cleared by the federal courts. And you can call down today. They have until May 7th. Yes, to the gentleman here, they are trying to evaluate the Metlakatla problem. Yes, the current board has definitely discriminated against Metlakatla and their heritage right of minority groups. Yes, they have definitely discriminated against the people Tionic who pleaded this year and who pleaded 2 years ago. They want to be connected with Kenai. They definitely discriminated against the people of Huna who made it very clear for all the years of being. They wanted to be connected with Baranoff Island where they live. They want to elect a legislator 400, 500 miles away. Metlakatla said, we don't want to be pushed into electing a legislator 600 miles away. We're too used to having a legislator 20 miles or 5 miles away to take care of our concern. So the gentleman brought up legitimate questions that have nothing to do with this bill, except they are concerned. They do discriminate against the people. This bill will answer some of the questions that the state Supreme Court says we must answer, because that way there will be less cases in the future. You are compelling any future reapportionment board to follow new guidelines and not have a very loose constitution.
You ready for the question? Representative Grusendorf.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Speaker. If the state of Alaska was just Anchorage, I could see where this piece of legislation would take care of some of the problems. But in the case that was cited by the past speaker, there was indication here that there was problems with the population count in Metlakatla and also in Huna. And in New Jersey, well, in New Jersey, the case he was using was New Jersey, which had a 1% was acceptable. Well, believe me, there's not the homogeneity in Alaska as there is in a small state like New Jersey. And some of these problems that exist in Alaska would only be compounded by the fact that the Metlakatla situation, the Hoonah situation, would be further aggravated by tighter parameters on it when these communities, especially the fringe rural communities, as they sit at the edge of a larger population center, and we have that 1%, 3% factor there, it takes them away from their cultural, their social, their economic sphere of influence. And I think that 1%, 3% is much too tight. Therefore, I'd have to...
Representative Kopanen.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. The lengthy answers of the sponsor of this resolution lead me to believe that he's using it primarily to... as a stick to beat the gentleman on the third floor with, rather than as a solution to the problem, which I thought he was putting forward originally. I'd like to elaborate on the points made by the previous speaker. There is a difference between percentages and absolute numbers. When you're speaking of a state like New Jersey or New York, California, where each of us would be representing, let us say, 50,000 people, that is the entire population of the state, it is much easier to come up with small percentage answers. But each of us represents approximately 8 or 9 people. if we're lucky, we know most of them. And sometimes we're unlucky if we know most of them. But nevertheless, we do represent a very small and also widely scattered population. Our friend, for example, from Sleepmute represents a small district in population, but a rather wide district in geography. If we were to be held to the 1%, 3% rule, one really wonders what possible distinctions could be made. Actually, I would imagine that we would have to cut people in half and give some of them one vote, one half vote in one district and one half vote in another, inside of the parameters that we have here. Also, it does propose an answer, and however, it locks us into one particular kind of answer. Single-member districts, double-member senatorial districts. Historically, this does not fit the Alaskan model, where we think of ourselves as representing sections of the state, real communities, communities that go beyond the political borders of our particular towns and cities, to be true, but nevertheless, which are discrete and separate. Fairbanks feels it's the heart of the interior, and in fact, in territorial days and in early statehood days, you did have representatives from the central district. You had the representatives from the northwest, from the old second judicial district. People were elected that way, or from a southeastern, from the first judicial district. Each district had a certain number of seats in the legislature. We ran as a body. Fairbanks kept that until the 1982 election, where we ran six candidates, six representatives from the Fairbanks North Star Borough running at large in the area. There were some very interesting results from that. If you remember, the interior delegation represented widely scattered points of view. My wife was an election judge at that time. I remember she came back shaking her head from one election, finding that people had voted for, on the same ballot, for two Republicans, two Democrats, and two Libertarians. I guess the individual voters felt they wanted to get as wide a scatter representing the community as possible. I'm not saying that that's an ideal solution. I'm saying that's the way that Alaskans tend to think, and that perhaps multi-member districts are a possibility that should have been talked about. What are the mechanisms that we could use to allow that? Certainly, it might be more flexible. It might be more creative than sticking with the medieval English model of single-member districts.
I think this is a matter that requires serious discussion, not just on this floor, but on lengthy committee hearings throughout the state. I think it should, this particular resolution should be voted down, but the question should be kept alive, and we should continue to examine it, perhaps in this session if it goes on too long, but at least in the next few years, and come up before the next census with a reasonable approach that fits the Alaskan geographical, numerical, and political traditions. Thank you.
Representative Gall.
Thank you. Could we have a brief at ease, please?
Will the House please stand at ease? Board.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I don't believe anybody has answered my question, and I would like to know this before I press the button, and maybe it isn't answered in this House Joint Resolution number 53, but I need to know if this was in place, would my mother and father, who live in South Anchorage, have to vote for in the same Senate district as the president of the other body from Palmer? It's a simple question, and I disagree greatly with that, and so do they in South Anchorage, and I just need to know if this would resolve it or does it.
Representative Martin.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Previously, the gentleman said the House district, and the House ticket was yes. Senate district, same answer, yes. Chances are it would be Prince William Sound and South Anchorage. That it would be one solution, not necessarily bringing in the Kiskis. There's other ways of adjusting the population disparity. But it could be right now separate seats, a Senate and a House seat. It's just a matter of who's ever on the board. You can't guarantee by a single member district that everybody will be in where they want to in a particular neighborhood. Then, Chairman, some of the other questions that were brought up were most important. One, the gentleman from Sitka mentioned that the mistaken population count. There was no mistake whatsoever. The people who did it knew what they were doing. It's just that the public was misinformed. In the Southeast, the problem is not Metlakatla being with Haynes. The problem is a policy question. A policy question, are two seats in Ketchikan necessary? Or should it be as what happened before, you had one person that lived in Ketchikan and took up those issues that were needed. You had another person that lived in the surrounding communities and was concerned. And together the two join in one effort with the senator in handling the community's problems. So you don't have to take Metlakatla out of the district by 600 miles. The people from Peterborough suggested, and very much the Southeast people were concerned as to how this gerrymandering went. They wanted the board to draw lines on an east-west basis, put us in segments as you go up the panhandle. Don't take one ice worm and wiggle all the way down. This is the case that's before Washington now. Is there a concerted effort of taking minority communities in the villages of Southeast Alaska and deliberately taking them away from neighboring Caucasian modern communities? Metlakatla, they said, we're putting it with Haynes because that gives you 41% native voting block for the ice worm, and that's documented. I know Mr. gentleman from Juneau raising his eyebrow before he showed you the document. The
reason of information, Madam Speaker. Excuse me, I'd like to understand where this is going, whose motives are being described here. There's been quite a lot of misinformation that I've allowed to go on.
Representative Gall, I do not believe that the speaker that presently has the floor has questioned any member of this body's motives. And I think the rule is clear that he may not question the motives of any member of this body. Mm-hmm. And I've not heard him do that. You may continue, Representative Martin.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I would be glad to supply that information that came from the Attorney General's office pertaining to the Voters' Rights Act and Metlakatla specifically of the potential discrimination of minority rights. The other part was the question of population. Does Southeast, with its minimal population now, have the rights to have six seats? The judge's rule in the last case, Carpenter versus Hammond, social economic condition cannot be superior to one person, one vote. And if you take a community out of the Southeast District, such as Cordova, with 2,300 population, you are further aggravating the problem of one person, one vote, equal representation. In the Southeast Anchorage, Southeast Alaska situation, it probably would have been better to bring in, the Prince William Sound, and that would have made it solid, rather than take population out and move it up. It would have been much better balance without being political or anything else, and just looking at a geographical problem. To bring Prince William Sound in, you would have kept your seats and everything else. Right now, the balance is way out of line. The gentleman said we should answer the socioeconomic problem in the Constitution. If you want to delete that from the Constitution to the gentleman from Southeast Anchorage, you have every right to amend it. And there's nothing that prohibits you from taking that part out. If you think it will be more justice to the state of Alaska, you're most welcome. I'll accept it as a friendly amendment to delete socioeconomic consideration from the Constitution. We also talked about villages. In today's population, Madam Chairman, 1% is 500 voters. And yes, you do have to be careful going around certain villages and dividing them and so on. But there's not too many villages in our western Alaska or even in Southeast that have 500. It's just a matter of what direction you want to go in that matters. We're not talking about cutting neighborhoods in half except in Anchorage. Thank you.
Mr. Szymanski.
I just want to, Madam Chairman, clarify a few points that the previous speaker has made. First of all, I do appreciate his bringing to my attention many of the issues that are before us in this legislation. He's provided excellent backup, and he should be commended for it. The sectional analysis was excellent, and I just want to assure him that I have reviewed the material. And it's because of that that I do have extreme problems and concern with the passage of this legislation at this time. And particularly when you look at what may be the effective date of this, if the voters of the state of Alaska adopt what's before us now, I understand that the intent is to be applied in 1990, but I don't know of any reason why a person who's litigating a reapportionment plan next year, which in all likelihood may come about, wouldn't demand that these rules be applied, and in all likelihood would have every reason in the world to apply them. And under that scenario, the single-member district, which I'm currently representing, and or the representation that may occur related to Nikiski, is not going to be solved. The problem still is there, that those people have the dilemma, the problem that's before them, because of the application of strict percentages which are outlined in this legislation. And I don't plan on voting for anything that's going to disenfranchise those people or other people of the state of Alaska. Thank you.
Representative Wendy.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. The debate today has, I think, highlighted one of the major problems that I see in how reapportionment issues have developed. The Constitution has made it, I think, very clear that there are a number of elements that have to be taken into consideration. Population is a very important part of that, but the social economic aspects and compactness are also very strong aspects of it. The courts have clearly tended to emphasize, and that the sponsor has clearly pointed that out to us, population. So what he has done with his resolution is to try and further emphasize that really, and I can see why he would encourage an amendment to take the social economic aspects out of the Constitution. Because it is clearly that the impact of this resolution would be to put the total emphasis of reapportionment on population. And when you have a state such as we have, with substantial distances between many communities outside of the districts in Anchorage, that compounds some real problems and I think will increase polarization and divisiveness within the state. The sponsor has made great deal comments about the intentions and the feelings of the people of Metlakatla. He is exactly correct to the extent that they are not happy with the current provision of the reapportionment proposal that is before the courts at this time. And they do that primarily because of the social economic ties that they have in their area. But to try and use that situation to suggest that they would in fact endorse this type of resolution try and diminish the social economic impacts and increase the population requirements is exact opposite of what the intent of the people of Metlakatla are. And I would consider myself a little closer to their position than would the sponsor, regardless of whether the newspaper of Anchorage considers him an expert on the subject or not. The situation as it would apply when you further emphasize population as his resolution does and dictate single member districts is you take a situation where you have maybe the city limits of Ketchikan would be one district, and then you take half of the borough of Ketchikan and put it in with Wrangell and half of Petersburg. That would fit within the population requirements of his bill. And there have been proposals before reapportionment boards in the past to do that exactly that. But as a representative from Sitka pointed out, that in areas outside of Anchorage, this plan, as he proposes, is totally unworkable and is a disservice to the state. For example, as has been proposed, do you split a town the size of Petersburg, put half of them in with a borough population in Ketchikan, and put half of them in with Sitka? That's ridiculous. But nonetheless, you have to do that type of surgery on the communities of our state in order to hit the restrictions of the population variances that the proposal is suggesting. And I would strongly urge that that's not in the interest of the people of Alaska, and it's not in the interest of the need for people in each community to work together. And there's no way to get around the population requirements of this resolution other than to have those types of divisions outside of Anchorage. If you can put one block of Anchorage to another, probably doesn't make much difference. But you start splitting up communities, that's going to be a travesty for the state. And I'd urge us to strongly reject this resolution.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Most of the things that I was going to say have been said by the previous speaker and the Democratic representative from Fairbanks, but to sum up there, I think that by placing the emphasis on the population differences in the districts, that this legislation does, in fact, discriminate against the rural areas of the state, and as pointed out by the representative from Fairbanks, reduces people's choice in the election in that if you're going to have single member districts when there's no good reason to do it other than an arbitrary statement in the Constitution, all you're doing is reducing people's freedom of choice. But I had a question. It's a technical one, which I have yet to understand having to do with the resolution. And that's on page 2 of the resolution under the new subsection that's added there. It states lines 22 through 24, in no case the absolute value of the total percentage deviations of all districts of a house divided by the number of districts exceed 1%. And as, if I understand that correctly, it would mean that, for example, if you had variations from the mean population among 20 House districts, and the sum of all those variations exceeded 20, that it would be outside this rule. Now, maybe I'm misinterpreting that. If that is a correct interpretation, it suggests the language in there is technically deficient because we'd be talking about a quotient, not a percentage point. But I'd like to get an explanation of that, and if that reading of it is essentially correct.
Representative Martin.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. When you begin playing with numbers, you can read different things into them. Basically, if we went by the 1980 statistics, let's round it off at 500,000. So therefore, you have 1% of 500. Leaving a 3% disparity up or down, that means that you have approximately 1,500 people up or down from one House seat to the other. And when we, courts have described in the common law, common sense that people in Harvard Law School have devised different mechanisms. You just cannot take one district against another district and leave that as a means of fair reapportionment. You also have to have a statewide percentage, whether it be 1% or 2%, to keep in balance, so that only so many districts will be limited to 3% or plus or 3% minuses before you have a disparity of more than 1% or 2% statewide. So the two have to be worked together, or that you can say, well, in this state here, we have every district that is no more than 5% above or 5% below, but the majority of the citizens of the area, no matter what pocket you use, may be deprived of 4 or 5 House members. That's the reason why you have to have both percentages, so that only so many districts can have a disparity of maximum point before a majority of the citizens are disenfranchised of equal representation.
You ready for the question?
Madam Speaker.
Representative Malone.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I guess then that I do have the correct understanding of that language in the new subsection B there. What it means, of course, is then that on the average, the variations can't exceed 1 percentage point times the number of districts. And if that's true, I think it would be nearly impossible to come up with an apportionment plan that made sense. You would definitely have to have lines running down the middle of communities, probably in some cases down the middle of people's houses.
Question?
Yes. Madam Chairman, I'd like to answer that one. There's no doubt that you may have some of that, but I can assure you not near as much in the proposed plan today. When we have one house, because people don't know the neighborhood, that is split right in half on East 20th Street in my neighborhood. So I think the mom is going to vote one way and dad is going to vote the other.
Are you ready for the question? The question is, shall committee substitute for House Joint Resolution 53 Finance pass the House? Members may proceed to vote. Does any member fail to vote? The clerk may lock the roll. Do any member wish to change their vote? The clerk may take the roll. Representative Schultz? Representative Schultz changing his vote from no to yes. Clerk may take the roll.
16 yeas, 20 nays.
And so committee substitute for House Joint Resolution 53 Finance has failed to pass the House. Representative Martin.
Madam Chairman, Madam Speaker, we'll get used to that eventually. Madam Speaker, I'd like to serve notice of my vote for reconsideration on House Joint Resolution number 53.
Representative Martin has served
Notice of reconsideration on House Joint Resolution 53. Will the clerk please read the next item on the calendar?
Committee substitute for Senate Bill 48, Judiciary, by the Judiciary Committee, an act relating to the adoption of regulations for state retirement systems. The Committee on State Affairs has had the bill under consideration and reports it back without recommendation. The report was signed by Mr. Abood, Chairman, signing Dupass, Abood, and Furness, having no recommendation, Cowdery, M.M. Miller, and Larson. I have no amendments on my desk, Madam Speaker.
Representative Abood.
Madam Speaker, I move and ask unanimous consent that the committee substitute for Senate Bill 48 Judiciary be considered engrossed, advanced to third reading, and placed on final passage.
Will the clerk please read the bill for the third and final time?
Committee substitute for Senate Bill 48 Judiciary by the Judiciary Committee, an act relating to the adoption of regulations for state retirement systems.
Question. The question is, first of all, is there debate? There being no Representative Miller.
I think it can be handled just in the by the clerk's office, Barbara, the secretary, but I think on line 15 of page 5, there needs to be the word elected placed before the word public. I think that's just could come under the category of a typographical error, because it's obvious we're talking about the EPORS system, but probably should be noted and corrected.
Line 15?
Yes, line 15 on page 5.
Are you ready for the questions? The question is, shall committee substitute for Senate Bill 48 Judiciary pass the House? Members may proceed to vote. Has any member failed to vote? The clerk may lock the roll. Do any members wish to change their vote? The clerk may take the roll.
37 yeas, no nays.
So committee substitute for Senate Bill 48 Judiciary has passed the House. Representative Miller.
Madam Speaker, can we be briefly at ease?
Will the House please stand at ease? Please read the next item on today's calendar.
Sponsor substitute for Senate Bill 350 amended by Ferguson, Fahrenkamp, Bennett, and Fakes, an act creating the Alaska United States Olympic Trust Fund and providing for an effective date. The Committee on State Affairs has had the bill under consideration and reports it back as follows and attaches a new fiscal note. The report was signed by Mr. Abood, Chairman, signing Dupass, Abood, and M.M. Miller, signing pass if amended, Locker, signing no recommendation, Cowdery, Larson, and Schultz. The Committee on Finance has had the bill under consideration and recommends it be replaced with House Committee Substitute for sponsor substitute for Senate Bill 350 Finance with the same title and reports it back with individual recommendations in a new fiscal note. The report was signed by Mr. Adams, Chairman, signing Dupass, Adams, Bettesworth, and Ward, having no recommendation, Jaroff, Martin, Grusendorf, and Fritz. I have one committee substitute on my desk, Madam Speaker.
Representative Abood.
Madam Speaker, I move and ask unanimous consent that Finance Committee substitute for sponsor substitute for Senate Bill 350 be adopted in lieu of the original bill.
Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. The House Committee substitute for sponsor substitute for Senate Bill 350 Finance is adopted in lieu of the original bill. Are there amendments?
I have two amendments on my desk, Madam Speaker.
Will the clerk please read the first amendment?
Amendment number 1 by Mr. Abood. It starts page 1, line 27, through page 2, line 3. And it has been duplicated and placed on each member's desk.
Representative Abood.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I move the amendment.
Is objection?
Objection.
There is objection. Representative Abood, do you want to discuss your amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I checked with the barrier group, come to find out that what it would do in reality is force the state to pay $1 million if that's what was raised through the private sector. And in addition to that, another million if the state employees put $1 million in. We would also be placing another million in, putting a cap on it, or rather coming up with a $2 million deal. Now, I, for one, feel that that we should have a cap on this. I certainly approve of sports, particularly the Olympics, etc., for our youth today and so on. Nevertheless, there's only a certain amount of money that I feel that the state should appropriate for this money, for these funds, or for these activities. What this amendment will do will to put them both together and state that in the aggregate, the sum appropriated should not exceed $1 million, both for the private sector donations and the contributions of the state employees.
Further debate, Representative Miller.
Yeah.
Excuse me, Representative Clarkson.
I hesitate to call a point of order because I'm not sure of the procedural status of this, Madam Speaker. I believe that the amendment is out of order because it violates Article 9, Section 7 of the Constitution with regard to a dedication of funds. I raise it as a point of order, although if the Speaker wishes, we can debate it. But I think that is a defect in the amendment. Article 9, Section 7 is the provision of the Constitution that says the proceeds of any state tax or license shall not be dedicated to any special purpose, etc. Seems to me this is precisely what is prohibited by the Constitution because it's a mandatory dedication of funds to a particular purpose and therefore prohibited.
Yes, may we have an adies, please?
The House, please stand at ease. Our legal counsel does not think this is a dedication of funds, since one legislature cannot bind another. And he feels that the amendment is not binding, and so therefore, I'm ruling the amendment in order. Representative Clarkson.
Then, Madam Speaker, I guess I could just speak on the merits of it, and I think what I'm going to do is oppose the amendment for the same reason. I do not agree with the interpretation by our legal counsel. I think it is clearly an appropriation. Obviously, the impact would be to bind a future legislature, and since, as he indicates, that's not appropriate, the amendment, in my mind, would not be appropriate. The amendment, I would have no objection to the amendment if it said something to the effect that the state may not appropriate any more than $1 million to this, because that would continue to leave discretion in the legislature to appropriate any amount down to zero. But once you state that a given minimum amount must be appropriated for a specific purpose, and since it is from a specific revenue source, I think that is a dedication and it's inappropriate.
Further debate? Representative Malone.
Well, thank you, Madam Speaker. On this amendment, and I guess the same thing that would apply to part of the original bill here, at least the part that talks about the appropriations not to exceed, but the question, I guess, on the amendment, I can ask it on the amendment, says in aggregate, the sum appropriated shall not exceed $1 million. Well, the limitation work either way as to whether requiring the legislature to appropriate a certain amount of money or prohibiting them from appropriating in excess of a certain amount of money. But I guess the question I have is this limitation then only apply to the matching funds, and that in addition to that, the legislature could appropriate whatever it thought required to this fund each year?
Representative Abood.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Madam Speaker, I'm sorry. I think if you read that carefully, if you read the first, you read the bill itself and then read the amendment, the bill itself, on line 29, all private donations not to exceed $1 million in the aggregate. And that's what the Billy Barrier group said. Now you go down to the number two, the salary deductions by all state employers and officers and employees. That meant to me, or it put the question in my mind, that if the donations came up to $1 million from the private sector, and let's assume, because there's no, some people have said, no, it won't be that much, but suppose it did go to $1 million for the state employees, that would mean the state then would have to have $1 million for both of them, or $2 million. What we've done by the amendment is coupled them together that the aggregate of both could not exceed $1 million, and yet it does not dedicate or does not specify $1 million to be put into it, only the aggregate to that. So therefore, I felt that it cleared up that particular section of it.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I find it difficult to understand why all the arguments are being made. It says quite clearly in the amendment in both the bill that the state shall make an appropriation, and if you want to read it differently, in the amount of donations by the public sector. In other words, it says it in several times in the bill. And to follow the wisdom of one of our senior members of the legislature here, this is not an appropriation bill. This is an authorization bill. And on the receipt by the state of donations from the private sector or from state employees in X amount of dollars, the legislature shall match those donations by an appropriation. There is no way that we could appropriate money now because we don't know whether we're going to raise any money or not through donations. This is going to be after the donations. Next legislature will match those private sector donations with an appropriation at that time.
Just a brief response, Madam Speaker. The Constitution does not prohibit appropriating the proceeds of any state tax or license. It prohibits the dedication of those. Therefore, I would argue that the Constitution prohibits not only the appropriation, but the authorization. This is an authorization.
Representative Bettesworth.
Well, if you remember real quickly, the gentleman from downtown Anchorage just said licenses and taxes. These are not license or a tax. It does not apply. It is neither one. It is a donation.
Further debate, Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Maybe the representative from Fairbanks could also answer a few questions which I have related to the amendment, but maybe more appropriate to the debate, which will center around the full bill itself. But the Alaska United States Olympic Trust Fund apparently doesn't exist today, yet we're somehow, I assume it doesn't exist today, and what we're going to be doing is creating it and then making only for the fiscal year 1985 up to $1 million appropriation. So I'm assuming then if this amendment is adopted, that the action to make contributions in the future will not exceed 1985. Is that correct?
Representative Bettesworth.
Okay, the last question. First, yes, that's correct. And it's also correct that as of today, no, there is not a United States Olympic Fund, but there is in the state of Alaska a United States Olympic Committee, which is appointed and functions in behalf of the United States Olympics. If I may, Madam Speaker, go on this issue. As you all well know, we're one of the maybe the only nation in the world who has adhered strictly to amateur athletics participating in the Olympics, in that we do not allow federal or funding of such activities. So recognizing that if this bill passes, and I sincerely hope that it will, there will be up to $1 million go into this fund. That $1 million of state funds cannot go to the United States Olympics program. It's the donated dollars from the private sector that will go to support the United States Olympics team for travel, housing, and so forth that they so desperately need to be able to compete with what are really professionals from the rest of the world. The balance of the state-funded money would go to promote and establish and encourage Olympic athletics within the state of Alaska in our different schools and whatnot. If I may, Madam Chairman, while I'm up here promoting the bill, There is concern.
Excuse me just a minute, Representative Bettisworth. We have too many people off the floor, so at this time I'm going to place a call on the House, and you may continue your debate.
Okay, just in favor of the bill, some people are concerned that this is an opt-in rather than an opt-out program. They say, well, if somebody wants to donate to the Olympics, they can, and this is true. But we all know that it's a lot easier to get something done in an organized manner, and the people that I've talked to about the pros and cons of donating to this program are quite happy that there is going to be an official, authorized organization sanctioned by the state of Alaska, hopefully by the legislature, that they may be a part of and contribute to, and therefore say, I am a member of this group, official group of people who are supporting the Olympic programs, both state and national. And that's what that makes this a desirable way and method of establishing a fund and funding that fund with state employees in the private sector. They get a lot more personal satisfaction, a lot more recognition in doing this as a concerted effort by a group than they would be as an individual.
Representative Abood.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. A most friendly point of order. We have strayed far from the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Abood. Further debate on the amendment?
Question.
Has the call been satisfied? Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Before we do a vote on the amendment, I need a little clarification on the principle behind what we're doing. It's my understanding, then, that the up to $1 million of state funds would be, as indicated in Section 2 of the bill, become the state's matching contributions of some type, and that those funds would not be going into, per se, a working trust fund, but would be strictly a distribution fund. In other words, the corpus of the fund would not be a working fund, and we would not just roll off the revenues from the fund, but indeed what we're really doing is we're setting up a special bank account to appropriate the funds to the Olympic Committee. Is that correct?
Representative Bettisworth.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. That is correct.
Further debate? I'm going to lift the call at this time. Are you ready for the question?
Question
is, shall Amendment Number 1 to House Committee Substitute for Sponsor Substitute Senate Bill 350 Finance pass? The House members may proceed to vote. Does any member wish to change their vote? The clerk may lock the roll. Does any member now wish to change their vote? The clerk may take the roll. Excuse me, Representative Hulbert.
Yes, no.
Representative Hulbert changing his vote from yes to no. The clerk may take the roll.
21 yeas, 14 nays.
Amendment has passed the House. Is there further amendments?
Yes, Madam Speaker.
Will the clerk please read Amendment Number 2?
Amendment Number 2 by Phillips, Locker, and Malone. It starts page 1, line 23. It has been duplicated and placed on each member's desk.
Representative Phillips.
Madam Speaker, move for the adoption of the amendment.
There is objection. Representative Phillips.
Madam Speaker, what the amendment basically does, it opts in rather than opting out. If I was a state employee, this form would come around and I would sign if I wanted to contribute towards the fund. Presently, the way the bill has it, it's the other way around. If I was a state employee, I would have to sign a form to get myself out of it from contributing. So basically what it does is it makes the freedom of choice placed upon the individual who is a state employee to place money into this fund.
Representative Larson.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chairman. I too rise in support of this amendment. and I'd like to read here the reason why I think it is absolutely necessary. Chapter 26 is the rights of state employees, whereby we outline the terms of employment. In Section 3926.010, Prohibited Act, it says that no department, agency, official, officer, or any person employed by the state may directly or indirectly, one, require or coerce any employee of the state to participate in any way, in any activity or undertaking, unless the activity or undertaking is related to the performance of official duties. And number four under the same section reads, coerce any employee of the state to invest or to contribute his earnings in any manner or for any purpose. So regardless how good I think we feel that this dedication of funds is, or the Olympic Committee is, I feel that we'd be going against our own statutes if we were not to adopt this amendment as proposed. Thank you, Madam Speaker.
Well, Madam Chairman, Madam Speaker, I'm sorry. The people who are most affected by that very statute that the representative from Mat-Su just read, namely the public employees, are not worried about it. They have expressed total neutrality on this bill. They're not seeking that we pass it. They're not seeking that we not pass it. They said in committee sessions that as long as they have the ample opportunity to opt out, they don't really care whether it's not opt-in or opt-out. So there's among the people who are most concerned by the statute that was just read by the previous speaker, there's total neutrality on the issue. They do not agree that that's a problem. Madam Speaker, I support the bill as written for the simple reason that I think, in all honesty, it'll raise a lot more money. And for this simple reason, I just base it on my own experience. I know what happens most of the time when I get an opt-in letter or something else. I think, oh, hey, that's a terrific idea. I'll set that aside and I'll probably do that. And then 18 weeks later, I get to the bottom of the stack and whatever it was I was going to sign is still there, and the program or whatever it was long since passed. And Madam Speaker, I don't think I'm atypical. I think that that's probably a pretty universal way that people act. So I really believe that if we leave the bill as